Okay, good morning, everyone. And welcome to Binah Term 3 and the new series on gratitude. Before I begin, I just wanted to mention that today's class is dedicated to, in the schus, in the merit of two people who have passed on, two neshamas and yahrzeit, Avraham Yisrael ben Chanoch and Eliel ben Yehuda Leib. The Yartza just recently, thank you for sponsoring the Shire, and it should be in the merit of their soul, and only good brachas and blessings. This is a great topic. In preparing today's session, the problem sort of wasn't what to say, the problem was what not to say. Because gratitude is a very, very extensive topic with lots of different components. And what we're going to do over the next number of weeks is take a journey together and try and develop a lot of these different ideas. But what we need to do today is just get a bit of an overview and a bit of an introduction so we can define the topic and understand sort of where we're going with it all. And what we'll end up doing today is mentioning a number of different ideas, which then over the next few weeks we'll come back and revisit them and develop them in greater detail. But just wanted to try and get a sense, a general sense of where we're going with this topic in today's session. So if we talk about gratitude, one of the dictionary definitions is the quality of or feeling of being grateful or thankful. So the words we think of when we talk about gratitude is being grateful, appreciation. But often what happens is that gratitude is seen as something which is a response. In other words, it's a response to something that takes place. So something happens to you, really, really good, obviously good, so you feel grateful. Someone gives you something which is of obvious benefit, so you're grateful, you say thank you. Someone does you a tremendous favor, saves your life, responsible for a tremendous blessing, for arranging something that you couldn't have dreamt of arranging on your own. So a polite person, a normal person, is grateful and you express appreciation. And of course, if you have good communication skills, you don't only feel grateful, but you express that gratitude. So you'll communicate, you'll say thank you, you'll give a gift, you'll make sure to communicate that you really are grateful and appreciative in a very strong way. But what's really important is that sometimes it's a bit of a misunderstanding of what really gratitude is, because I suppose if I sum it up, what I really want to try and achieve over the next few weeks in this discussion is two things. First of all, to move away from gratitude being a response, but rather make it into a mindset. In other words, gratitude is not a response to something. It includes a response, but gratitude really is a mindset. It's a way of thinking. It's a constant way of thinking. And that's really, really important. That's something that we're going to really, really develop in greater detail. And the second thing, I suppose the best way to put it is, what I want to try and achieve and do and communicate to you is to turn gratitude from something which is a noun into something which is a verb. In other words, it's not just a feeling that exists. It's something that we have to work on. To develop that mindset is something we have to work on, something we have to develop. It's something you actually have to do on a constant basis. In order to feel gratitude, in order to have a mindset of gratitude, in order to live a life filled with gratitude, which we'll talk about the obvious importance and benefit of that in a minute, there's a lot to do, there's a lot of work to do. There's mindset changing, there's exercises that we need to actually engage in, and there's lots of things that we need to develop and practice in order to develop that mindset of gratitude. So gratitude therefore becomes a mindset, and it involves action, it involves active work and processing and exercises to actually arrive there and to reach there. So we need to begin by highlighting a few concepts which sort of emphasize the importance of gratitude and the benefits of gratitude. First of all, an interesting idea that one of the very, very early and probably one of the first failings of the human being was the lack of gratitude. Right? I often refer because it's such a great model. I often refer back to the very, very first story in Genesis. Almost one of the first stories of the Chumash, which is the sin of the forbidden fruit, right? So God gives the command to Adam and Eve and not to eat from the Eitz Hadaat, the tree of knowledge, the tree of life. And the snake comes and persuades Eve to take some fruit, and she takes some fruit and gives it to her husband, to Adam. And eventually when God holds them to account, and of course we've talked about that one of the obvious failings of the very, very first transgression was a lack of self-control. But that's not the topic at hand. But the lack of gratitude also comes into it, because the great commentator Rashi makes the point that when God approaches Adam and he says to Adam, why did you eat from this fruit? Like, how come I told you for 3 hours to sort of just control yourself, not eat from this fruit, and you couldn't control yourself and you ate it. So what does he do? He shifts responsibility right away. He blames and he says, well, my wife. Right? She gave it to me. Ha'isha. Ha'isha Hashem atata imadi. The wife that you gave to me gave me this fruit. Now, that sentence is a loaded sentence because it means lots of things. And one of the things, of course, is shift of responsibility, blaming, not taking responsibility, etc. But Rashi, the great commentator Rashi, makes another slight point. As soon as that Pasuk says those words, Rashi makes the point and he says, Kan kafui tova. Here Adam was ungrateful. Just before, we read in the Torah that Adam was lonely. Adam craved a relationship. He saw that even the animals were created in partners, spouses. And yet, and he was lonely, and God said, Lo tov ha'adam, it's not good for the man to be alone or lonely, whatever the translation is. And God creates Eve and creates a wife, brings her to Adam. He's happy, he's grateful. But as soon as a little problem, why'd you give me this wife? Right? Ungrateful. That's what Rashi says. Right? So from the very, very first failings of the human being is the lack of gratitude, because it's easy to shift, and we'll see that in the coming discussions. It's very easy to slip into an attitude of ungratefulness, of lack of gratitude. You have to actually work at constantly being grateful. Now, I want to just initially sort of highlight some of the Jewish sources and have a look at it from a Jewish perspective about the importance, what the Torah actually has to say about the concept of gratitude. Now, we know that when we look at the Torah, all its values, its mitzvot, its commandments, its concepts, its lessons, we find that the Torah is divided up into various categories. So the more famous subdivision is the difference between Bein Adam LaMakom and Adam LaChavero, which means mitzvot between man and God, and mitzvot between man and man. So we have those responsibilities that are between us and God, the spiritual mitzvot, the rituals, the various things, the various responsibilities that we have which are between us and God. And then there's the responsibility and the appropriate behavior and the proper relationships and conduct between people. So it's all a mitzvot about not stealing and not cheating and etc. And then the famous Vilna Gaon says there's a third category. There's the responsibilities that a person has to himself, to him or herself, which he calls Bein Adam Le'atzmo. Right? So it's between man and God, between man and man, between man and himself. That's one way of dividing up the various concepts and the various values that we learn. There's also another division, and that is just to understand that when we go through life's experiences and we respond to other people or respond to ourselves and we engage in our various responsibilities and in morality and in good behavior and in good conduct and etc., we operate on three levels. We operate on the level of thought, speech, and action. Right? So whatever the subject is at hand, whatever the concept is, we're thinking about it, we're thinking about it, we're talking about it, and we're acting, we're behaving. So just bear in mind these two ways of dividing up. So one is between us and God, between us and man, between us and ourselves. The other is that whatever we're engaged in, we're always operating on three levels: thought, speech, and action. And I mention this because if you have a look at the Jewish sources, the Torah sources, you'll see that the importance of gratitude, the idea of gratitude, is highlighted in such an emphasized way on all of these levels. Every division that we've just mentioned, we find the concept and the importance of feeling and expressing and demonstrating gratitude. Let's just give a couple of examples so we understand. First of all, between us and God, the concept of being grateful to God, which is really where gratitude starts. And from a Jewish perspective, gratitude is so important because, and this is something we'll develop in greater detail further, but gratitude is so critical because one of the fundamentals of Judaism is that we cannot take anything for granted. That we don't self-create anything, we're not really in control, and things that we're able to achieve and blessings that we're able to receive come from somewhere, they come from God. Right? It's 101 of Judaism, right? So therefore, we find in the Torah specific commandments which are designed to express that gratitude. For example, two examples is the famous mitzvah of Bikurim. Bikurim was the bringing of the first fruits, which in the temple times the Jews used to do on the festival of Shavuot. Right? So the idea was that the Jews went into the land of Israel, they started to plow the land and farm the land, they grew vegetables, they grew fruit, particularly the fruit which was considered a luxury and tasteful fruits, etc. Particularly there's the seven fruit for which Israel was praised with and stood out with. And then the law was that every single year when a farmer would go into the field and see the fruit sprouting, he would take from the first fruits, put it into a basket and decorate it and take it all the way to Jerusalem and give it as a gift to the Kohen, the priest, which was symbolic of giving it to God. And it's clear from the verses, the context there is, that the purpose of this mitzvah was gratitude. To show gratitude, to demonstrate, to say thank you to God for the fruit. Thank you to God for the blessings that we have. There's another concept also called Korban Todah, which was a special sacrifice that was brought in, again, once again in temple times, which was called a thanksgiving sacrifice. And that was specifically designed if someone went through a very difficult, challenging time or traveled through a desert which was perhaps dangerous or across the sea which was unsafe and survived and made it through in one piece, there was a special sacrifice that used to be brought to say thank you to God. So therefore we have between man and God, we see this concept of todah, saying thank you, of being grateful, of showing gratitude between a human being and God. But then of course there's the gratitude between people. Right? To show gratitude to another human being, which is a very interesting topic in its own right, because it actually is connected with a very deep theological discussion. But where it comes up mainly is in the mitzvah of kibud av em, honoring parents. Right? We know that one of the Ten Commandments is the command of honoring parents. And the Torah says, kabed et avicha v'et imecha, you should honor your father and mother. And the question is, why? I mean, what's obviously, I mean, it makes sense to honor your father and mother, but what's the rationale, what's the basis, what's the concept behind the mitzvah? So there was a great writer, he was named, called the Sefer HaChinuch. Sefer HaChinuch, because that was the book he wrote, called the Book of Chinuch. I don't know his name, because it's anonymous. But we do know that it was a 13th century author, who wrote a book on the Parsha of the Week, highlighting all the mitzvot in the Chumash. And in every mitzvah, a very, very fascinating book, a beautiful book, where he goes through every mitzvah of the Torah, all 613 of them, and he sort of defines what the mitzvah is, he gives some sort of philosophical perspective, and then he talks a little bit about the laws of the mitzvah. Very one book, one volume book. It was a book actually that the author of Sefer HaChinuch, we're not quite sure who it was, but there's speculation, we're not quite sure who the author was, but we do know that, because he writes about it in the Sefer HaChinuch, that he wrote it actually for his son. He wrote it for his son and for the youth, because it's actually quite simply written. And he wrote it for his younger son and his friends, his son's friends, to have something to read on Shabbat afternoon. Interesting background. And it became a book which is very, very great, studied all over. So he writes the following, on the mitzvah of kibud av v'em, on the mitzvah of honoring one's father and mother. And he says, Mishor shei mitzvah zu, from the fundamentals of this mitzvah, from the essence of the mitzvah, he says, what is it? And let me just quote to you, because the words are beautiful. I'll try and translate as best I can in English. He says, it is appropriate and fit for a person to recognize and to demonstrate kindness to someone that has done you a favor. And a person should never be low to be ungrateful and to deny the good that he has been given. Right? Because he says, Shazu midah ra'ah. This is a terrible personality trait. I'm reading the words because just show how emphasized it is. ومؤساب بالتخليت, and it is completely and utterly despised before God and people. In other words, being ungrateful, he says, is a terrible trait and a despised and despicable thing to be ungrateful. And therefore, as a basis for that concept, God gave us the mitzvah to honor our parents. Why? Because besides the fact, he says, and this highlights also the idea of what gratitude is and how one should exercise gratitude. Again, we're going to discuss this in the next few weeks. But he says, besides the fact, of course, they've done so much for us, that's not the reason. The reason is because they brought us into the world. That's it. We exist because of them. That's enough. If just for that alone, because, you know, we all as every person today as parents has something to say or something to think about the the deficits or the because we all know better, of course, in the previous generation, that's generational. And we all make mistakes. My parents, I'm sure, made lots of mistakes. I make lots of mistakes as parents. My kids will make mistakes too, probably, right? And that's fine. And we're all beneficiary of mistakes, or we think we're beneficiary of mistakes, whatever the case is. But that's not the point. The Sefer HaChinuch says that the reason that God obligates us, and perhaps now's the time to go in great detail, maybe it'll come up in some further weeks, but if one has a look at the Shulchan Aruch, at the Code of Jewish Law, and the Talmud, and the writings about the mitzvah of honoring parents, the extent to which Jewish practice and Jewish law expects us to honor one's parents is unbelievable. I'd venture to say most people are not actually aware of the halachic obligation that we have in honoring parents. And especially in our generation where, you know, the boundaries of respect have sort of been, respect and honor and honor and all this, and all associated things have been somewhat destroyed, one could say, and dismantled, right? And it's not a generation which emphasizes hierarchical relationships very well. You know, people call their great teachers and professors, everyone's by first names today, etc., etc., right? So if you look in true, authentic Jewish law and the extent to which one has to go to honor one's parents, let's just talk about that mitzvah for a second, just the mitzvah of honoring parents is amazing.
What about parents that abuse their children?
So that's an incredible discussion about what they're... Yeah. And so the term abuse, obviously, is a very loaded word. I mean, the short answer is that children who grow up in an abusive relationship, if it's real abuse, in the proper understanding of the word, then the obligation does change. It does change, and that's subject of a different discussion, perhaps for a different topic. But when we say that grow up in an abusive relationship, that's very different than growing up in a strained relationship, right? Because you know, often people have disagreements or tension or conflict. That's not abuse, right? And very, very often people fail to understand that the obligation of honoring parents, even in strained relationships. Now, of course, one has to have boundaries and doesn't have to be a victim of people's control, etc. But nevertheless, the obligation is much, much more on the child than it is on the parent. And it's an interesting thing to explore, perhaps for a different time. But the reason that I'm emphasizing it so much, the reason I'm going into a bit more detail, is because all of that and all of what's written about honoring parents according to the Sefer HaChinuch, all the obligations and all the unbelievable obligations of respect and honor one has to give parents is based on one thing only: gratitude. Showing gratitude. Because a person has to show gratitude to another person that has given you something. And what we're showing gratitude for, in other words, all the amazing laws and the detailed laws that are involved in honoring parents, is to show gratitude for one thing. Thank you for bringing me into the world. Thank you for being that conduit and responsible for me existing. Above that, of course, there's, you know, for getting up for me in the middle of the night and for feeding me and clothing me and all the heartache, etc., etc. But besides all of that, that's just a cherry on the top. What it begins with is just the fact that I'm here. And then there's an amazing point, which I just couldn't resist mentioning because while we're on this topic, that another commentary, a famous commentary in the Chumash called the Kli Yakar, who was a 16th century sage who lived in Prague. His name is Shlomo Ephraim. And he makes an interesting observation. And he says, you know, if you look at the Ten Commandments, there's five and five, right? And the famous division of, or the accepted division of the Ten Commandments is that the first five are between man and God. and the second father between man and man. So the first father is, I am Hashem, your God, don't serve idols, don't swear falsely, talk about the Shabbat. The second set talk about between relations, don't kill, don't steal, don't commit adultery, etc. Right? So between man and God, and you actually see it. If you look in the first line, you know, I'm sure there's often the Ten Commandments, you look in the first, the right-hand side, each command mentions the name of God. On the left-hand side, it actually doesn't mention the name of God because the emphasis of the other five commandments are between man and man. The confusing thing, however, is that the mitzvah of honoring parents is the fifth command. It's on the side of between man and God, not between man and man. And it mentions God's name. All right, it says that. But, and also, it's one of the only two mitzvahs of the Torah where the Torah actually emphasizes the reward, which is longevity. And it says, honor your parents because through that you'll have a long life that a God will give you, right? And the Kli Yaakov points out is because he says the two gratitudes are inseparable. The two gratitudes, gratitude that you express between man and man, and gratitude you express to God, which is symbolized in the mitzvah we talked about before, the mitzvah bringing the first fruits, they're inseparable because one cannot show gratitude to one without gratitude to the other. Gratitude to one's parents, understanding a very tangible, physical thing, that I owe a debt of gratitude to two people who are responsible for my existence, naturally then extends to a greater mindset of gratitude where I don't take anything for granted, and I realize that everything I have in my life comes from God, and therefore I show gratitude to God also. And therefore ultimately he says, although it's a gratitude between man and man, it ends up and extends and develops into a gratitude between man and God. That's what's on that side. Okay. But then there's a whole nother level, an idea and concept behind the concept of gratitude. Because remember we said before the three divisions are between man and God, man and man, and man and himself, right, and herself. And that is, we find countless examples, and many of them we'll go over the next few weeks, but I want to mention one or two today. Countless examples in the Torah that the importance of gratitude is so important because it's important for the person showing gratitude. In other words, it's like many of the things we've discussed that we give to other people. That very often those things we give to other people are important for ourselves, not for the other person necessarily. Right? If you remember, for example, we talked about this in forgiveness. But of course, it's really, really important for me to forgive someone because it's important for them to be forgiven. Because if they did something against me, they carry a burden of transgression, a burden of guilt until they become forgiven. And my responsibility to them is not to be cruel and to forgive them. But at the same time, we discussed in great length that the benefit of forgiveness is probably more for the person forgiving than the person being forgiven. And this is incredibly true when it comes to gratitude also, and of course ties into the whole concept of developing a mindset of gratitude. And the example I want to share with you so it becomes clear is this. We often talk about the story of Exodus, when Moses took the Jewish people out of Egypt. When that happened, so as a prelude to the whole Exodus of Egypt, we know we talk about the 10 plagues. Right? Now, the one individual that was responsible for leading the Jewish people out of Egypt was Moses. Right? Moses goes to Midian, he's the burning bush, God appoints him the leader of the Jewish people and says that every detail, every component of the Exodus story and redemption must take place through him. And therefore, he's the one to go to Pharaoh, he's the one to negotiate with Pharaoh, he's the one to warn Pharaoh of the punishments, and he's the one to, so to speak, administer and be God's messenger to carry out the 10 plagues. Now, we find with the 10 plagues, if you look in the story, you'll find an interesting thing, that many of the 10 plagues, for whatever reason, I mean, they were all miraculous, but God wanted a particular physical action to take place in this world that should be the catalyst, so to speak, to bring about the plague. Like, for example, the first plague was the plague of blood. So God said, you need to hit the river Nile, right? Hit the river Nile and the water will turn to blood. That needs its own discussion because, of course, if God could turn the Nile into blood, why does he need someone to hit the Nile? But, okay, but whatever the reason is, that's the way it worked, okay? And here we see a fascinating thing. That although Moses was the one in charge, he was the one to administer and be God's messenger in every single step of the way, the first three plagues, blood, frogs, and lice, which the tangible, symbolable action that was the catalyst for the plague was hitting the river and throwing dust. So for blood and for frogs, they have to hit the river, and that would bring up the frogs or turn the water to blood. And for lice, God said to take a piece of earth and to throw the earth, and all the earth, the dust would turn to lice. For those three plagues, God says to Moses, you have to tell Aaron to do it. You can't do it. Why not? Because God says to Moses, when you were a baby and you were born and you needed to be hidden, they hid you in the Nile River. You cannot smite the Nile River. As important as it is, as critical as it is for the Egyptians to have the plague of bloods and frogs, you cannot smite the river because that's ungrateful. Ungrateful to who? Ungrateful to the river? Does the river have feelings? But it's an act of ungratefulness. You need to step aside. You are the leader, but you need to step aside because you cannot smite the river. Because smiting the river will instill in you a bad trait. You owe it to yourself not to smite the river. And therefore, when it comes to this, step aside, ask Aaron to do it. The river needs to be smitten. The river was a deity. You know that the Egyptians served the River Nile as an idol. Right? It's not like we had great compassion for the River Nile. The River Nile was abused and misused by the Egyptians. It was impure. It was considered one of the greatest impurities because it was used by the Egyptians as an idol. It doesn't matter. You were saved by this Nile. Your mother put you in a basket and put you in the River Nile to protect you for 3 months or for whatever it was, a few days until you discover it. You can't smite it. And the same thing with the dust. Why couldn't he take the piece of earth? An amazing thing. Because if you remember, there's a story in Chumash where Moses goes up. He grows up in the palace of Pharaoh, and he goes out and he sees an Egyptian that was beating a Jew. Right, that was the beginning of his leadership. And he felt terrible, so he decided he's going to take action, correct action. And what does he do? He looks here and there, says the pasuk, and he smites the Egyptian. He kills the Egyptian to protect the Jew, as he should have done, which was fine. But then he needed to get rid of the evidence. So what does he do? Which didn't help, because actually there was someone who watched and went and informed him. And Pharaoh, that's why he had to run away for a period of time. Okay, but in order to hide the evidence, he hid the Egyptian, he buried the Egyptian in the earth. Which was some sort of protection at least. Said, God, you buried the Egyptian in the earth, you used the earth, you can't smite the earth. And therefore tell Aaron to do it. I think those two examples, probably even more than the mitzvah of honoring parents or bringing bikurim, show and demonstrate the whole process that we're about to embark on. The mindset of gratitude. Earth doesn't have feelings, the Nile doesn't have feelings, but you need to have a mindset of gratitude. You, a person, cannot do something that is an act of ungratefulness, that shows lack of gratitude, because it's bad for you. Because a person must embark on a process where we continuously progress and we develop a mindset of gratitude, not the opposite. Smiting the river would regress. In other words, it would make him go back. Okay, so that's a good question. But so that's an ethical discussion to have, and we probably should have it. The short answer is because the guy was self defense on behalf of the Jew. In other words, it was the only way to get him off the, or he was going to kill the Jew. So and unjustly so, he was being it for no reason. He was being it because they were under persecution. So you can't just indiscriminately kill someone, but if someone is being threatened unjustly, then you can do whatever it takes to protect that person. If the only way to do it is to kill the person, then you're allowed to. Then it is the ethical thing to do. I'm not suggesting we go on the street sort of do it, but okay, but that's okay. But at the end of the day, the earth did him a favor. That was the idea. All right. The earth did him a favor, therefore you can't smite the earth. I'll take it even one step further, and something I was probably going to bring in a bit later, but let's bring it in now, just to emphasize the point. We were persecuted by Egypt for 210 years. It wasn't five-star accommodation, and only 11, right? Yeah, we know there's an amazing thing. Later on in the Chumash, when the Jews were in the desert, they got the various commandments that were given the Torah, and they were given the whole set of laws to do with relationships, and who they can marry and who they can't marry. One of the mitzvot is, for example, there's the nation of Moab. Now, Moab mistreated the Jewish people terribly when they came out of Egypt. They came to greet them, and the Jews thought they were going to be providing them with sustenance, and they didn't. They provided them with, they sort of killed a lot of them, and there was a whole thing, right? And therefore, as a punishment for the nation of Moab, again, and all these things need their own discussion, but just to bring out the point that we want to apply to this. As a punishment for the nation of Moab, the law is that if someone from the nation of Moab converts, a male that is, they have limitations of who they can marry. They can't actually marry into sort of mainstream Jewish community as a punishment. Normally, anyone who converts can marry whoever they want, but the Moab people can't. Similarly, God placed restrictions on Egyptians. By the way, all this doesn't apply today because we don't know who's who anymore. The world has been all mixed up. So we're talking about in the times where people were still on the original geographical locations. The Egyptians are the same thing. The Egyptians nowadays, well, we're not the same Egyptians as before. It's all different. So the Egyptians are the same thing. After all, Egypt persecuted us for 210 years, 86 of which were terrible, terrible persecutions and decrees. And therefore, if an Egyptian converts, again, there's restrictions on who they can marry. But suddenly, the Torah tells us that there's a leniency when it comes to Egyptians. When it comes to the nation of Moab, who just indiscriminately, unprovoked, when you came out of Egypt, had nothing to do with you, came out to greet you and just killed you, we punish them severely. When it comes to Egyptians, however, God says, there's certain people they can marry, and once they in the Jewish nation for three generations, then they can marry mainstream. Leniency. Why the leniency all of a sudden? Egyptians, I mean, they were the worst. So listen to this. The Talmud says the leniency is because you need to show a certain level of gratitude to Egypt. At the end of the day, you had where to live for 210 years. It wasn't exactly five star, but you had where to live. You were a big nation. You couldn't just go anywhere. They gave you where to live. It shows you an incredible insight into the concept of gratitude, which we need to develop in much greater detail, but just to sow the seeds. Sometimes you can have a situation that is completely negative, but there's some positive, and you have to be able to uncover that positive. To uncover that positive and to develop a mindset of gratitude, to be able to be grateful for the positive. You deal with the negative as well. And the Torah does with Egyptians. It does punish them. And punish them severely when they left Egypt. But what they deserve gratitude for, they deserve gratitude for. At the end of the day, we had where to live for 210 years. We have to show some level of gratitude. So therefore, there's a leniency to remember that, you know, even then, bottom line is, don't just turn your back on them because you had where to live. So that's the three divisions of between man and God, man and man, and man and man themselves. And the same thing with regard to how we operate, right? We said before that there's three levels of operation. We operate on thought, speech, and action. So here again, we see many, many sources and examples of how one should develop gratitude on all three levels. It's not sufficient just to develop gratitude on one of them. So on thought, of course, that's the idea. You need to feel gratitude. That's the idea of Moses not smiling the river because it would give him a feeling of ungratefulness. But speech is very, very important also. Let's go back to that mitzvah of Bikurim. Bikurim is bringing the first fruits, right? When the person would bring the fruits to the temple, that bringing the fruits was a gift. It was a gift to God, so to speak. It was a gift to demonstrate gratitude. But that was only part of the mitzvah. When the farmer came to Jerusalem and brought the basket of fruit, part of the mitzvah was to make a declaration. He had to stand in front of the altar, that's the way it's taught, and in front of the Kohen and actually make a long declaration. It's a summary of Jewish history to date, and it was about thanking God for the fruit, thanking God for the land of Israel and for the fruit that we're able to eat. So he's bringing the basket of fruit, so why does he have to make a declaration? So once again, the same Sefer HaChinuch makes the point, and he says like this. He says, because one of the most powerful, and we've talked about this many, many times, one of the most powerful tools that a person has that arouses and enhances and fuels emotions is the power of speech. When we talk fuels emotions. We've talked about this many, many times. Negative and positive. When a person is angry, the best thing is to be quiet, because if you talk, the speech enhances the emotion, it fuels it. Positive emotions are the same way. That's why in a relationship it's so important to express love verbally, to express appreciation, to talk about your emotions, because speech fuels emotions. And therefore the Torah says action is very important. But when you bring the bikurim, you bring the basket, it's not enough just to do it, just to say, thank you, I'm bringing the basket. You need to talk about it. You need to get up and actually make a declaration. Explain why you're here. Who are you explaining to? We all know why you're here. You need to explain why you're here, because you need to develop the emotion. You need to feel gratitude. And the more you talk about it, the more you feel it, and therefore there's a declaration that goes together with that mitzvah. But of course, speech alone is not enough either. Because sometimes people talk a lot about emotion, but don't do anything about it. And therefore, of course, therefore it's got to operate on all levels. It's got to then travel from speech to action, which is why it's not enough just to say thank you, you have to bring a basket. When a person went through a dangerous travel or came out of a severe sickness, you have to bring a sacrifice. Even in today, modern day Jewish law, we find there's an interesting concept. When if someone was in a family, was God forbid, very, very ill, or someone went through a very, very traumatic time, or someone was in a very, very close car accident and got saved miraculously, whatever the case is, or just something really, really good happens, right? There's a concept in Jewish law today called Seudat Hoda'a, to make a meal of Thanksgiving. Call your friends and make a meal of Thanksgiving. Some people have a custom, they do it every year. If something good happened, like an amazing thing, every year on the anniversary, they'll call together friends and make a meal. Now, why make a meal, other than the fact that Jewish people just connect everything with the meal? Right? Like, we need to say thank you. Obviously, we've got to eat, right? But there's a very deep reason for it. The reason is because, the reason, by the way, that we eat every time we do anything, right, is to make it tangible. It's to make it real. That's the reason. Pesach night is the same thing. What is Pesach night? What is the Seder? The Seder is a process of gratitude. In fact, that's what's written all over. It says that the Pesach is to say thank you to God. So why don't we just sit and say the Haggadah? Yeah, we've got to say it. Speech is very important. Not enough. You've got to eat. You've got to eat matzah. You've got to drink wine. You have to do something tangible. It's got to be... Because if we're talking about gratitude, not just as a response to something, thank you, did something really good for me, thank you very much, but it's something about developing a whole mindset, it's developing a personality of gratitude, developing a mindset of gratitude, then it's got to live on all levels of operation. We've got to think about it, we've got to talk about it, and we've got to do action. We've got to actually implement and do tangible things that are actions of gratitude. And therefore, it's got to come on all levels as well. So it's on all types of relationships and on all levels of operation. Now, gratitude, besides being a moral responsibility and just a good way of living and a critical way to develop as a human being, but of course, gratitude has tremendous benefits, which is now very well researched and well documented. One of the greatest things that people seek is happiness. Right? Everyone seeks happiness. I haven't yet met a Meshuggah that should say he doesn't want to be happy, right? But everyone wants to be happy. Not everyone knows what happiness is, by the way, but that's a separate issue. But everyone wants to be happy. And of course, we've talked about this before, that real happiness is not just smiling and dancing. Real happiness is an inner happiness. It's an inner sense of satisfaction, inner sense of purpose, an inner sense of focus, etc. What we now know is that developing a mindset of gratitude is completely linked with happiness. That gratitude actually brings happiness. Now, I'm just going to mention it briefly today because I wanted to just set the topic, but we're going to develop this over the next few weeks. But this comes out of some interesting stuff that I was reading. There's a whole body of literature today on what we call positive psychology. There's a book written by Christopher Peterson called Positive Psychology, where he develops the idea of what positive psychology is, just very briefly, which is a nice idea in its own right. He talks about psychology in general having what he calls a long past but a short history. What he means by that is that people have been dealing with psychological concepts ever since we were created, right? But as a formal discipline, it's not more than 100 years old, really, right? Now, that's true with psychology in general. He then goes on to develop this idea that that's completely true with this concept called positive psychology, which is now a scientifically researched concept. I'm not just talking about a sort of a, you know, pop psychology or something. I'm talking about now a proper discipline of psychology, which is now developed and was developed primarily by a person called Martin Seligman, I think his name is. And he explains the following idea. He says that for many, many years, and I'm going to go into a bit of detail with this because only because it sets the foundation to developing this mindset of gratitude, and it'll be very, very linked. For many, many years, psychology generally is focused on what's wrong. Correct? Not what's right necessarily. In other words, a person has a problem, the problem needs to be remedied, the problem needs to be dealt with, it needs to be diagnosed, it needs to be understood. So therefore we delve into the human mind, we delve into the workings of the brain, and we try and discover where the deficit is, where's the problem. And we give therapy for the problem, or remedy to the problem, and we address what the problem is. And that's been developed to a very, very great degree, and to an effective degree. Modern psychology is tremendous in its research and its development. Of course, again, it's something with a very, very long history, particularly if you understand, as we've done very often here, we understand the concepts of Judaism. Many of these ideas have been around since the Torah was given at Mount Sinai. But it's been developed and researched into a very, very effective and successful formal discipline. But the emphasis has been tremendously a lot of times on what's wrong, not what's right, right? So as he says, we become a nation of self-identified victims, right? And so positive psychology now proposes to do the other way around. Not to discard psychology, because, and that's an important thing to understand, by the way. When someone tells you we should ignore what's wrong, that's a big problem, right? That's what we call denial. If someone has a problem, they have a problem. A problem needs to be dealt with. That's not to be discarded. That's not to be undermined, right? Because people do have weaknesses. People do have problems. People have sometimes very, very deep problems. They're coming out of circumstance or inborn personality traits or the wiring of the brain or whatever the case is. But nevertheless, although that shouldn't be discarded, but it needs to be alongside a whole nother discipline. A discipline of positive psychology, which is, the basis of it is focusing on what's right. In other words, developing the strengths of the human being, developing what is right with the human being, diagnosing what is working well within the human psyche and the human personality, and developing it and nurturing it, and letting it enhance the general well-being of the person. And often doing that automatically removes a tremendous amount and a tremendous level of what is wrong. Now, I mentioned that for two reasons. First of all, as a basis to the next thing, but before we go there, that is very much connected to what we're going to be doing and developing when it comes to gratitude. Because developing a mindset of gratitude, as we'll see in the next few weeks, requires tremendous strength and tremendous effort to learn not only within ourselves, but within the world around us, to identify what is right rather than to identify what is wrong. We all have things that are wrong, and that's fine. But that doesn't give us gratitude. But we all can develop a mindset of gratitude. And developing a mindset of gratitude can only happen through training ourselves to identify the good. And again, I'm talking about gratitude not as a response. As a response, gratitude as a response is when you respond to something that's obviously good. Developing a mindset of gratitude means to go beneath the obvious, to understand that there's a lot that's good and a lot to be grateful for before we get to what's obvious. And that requires a mindset shift and it requires a whole perspective on life to focus on what's good, similar to what I just shared with you in terms of positive psychology. But going back to this whole idea, one of the studies that they did, a scientifically research-based study, was the link between gratitude and happiness. Right? And in a recent research, they talked about different psychology exercises. One of them was called the gratitude visit. And it involved actually identifying someone that has done something good for you and going and thanking them or writing them a note, whatever the case is. And they were able to track scientifically how every time a person or every person who engaged in what they called the gratitude exercise also had an increase in their levels of happiness. Shows you the incredible link between real happiness and gratitude. So gratitude, therefore, is not just a critical part of human development and human growth, but actually is much broader than that. And when we can develop a mindset of gratitude, we become more meaningful people, happier people, and it actually, in the long term, we'll develop this, has a positive effect on our physical well-being. Besides our mental well-being, it actually has a real effect, because happiness then in turn also has a complete effect on the way we act physically. It lessens depression-type attitudes and has a positive effect on how we live. But in order to do that, it takes a lot of effort, it takes a lot of thinking and a lot of processing, and these are some of the concepts which we're going to develop over the last few weeks. Let me just end with a beautiful story that I read, which will set the tone for what we're going to do. And I'm not 1,000% sure if the story is true, but it's a beautiful story anyways. But it's a story about Yitzhak Perlman, which is a very, very famous violinist, who, as you know, was born with polio and comes on the stage with crutches and braces, etc., etc. So the story goes apparently like this, that he once appeared on the stage to a packed audience, and when he came on the stage, slowly he made his way to his seat, as he does, sat down, everyone applauded him, the audience went quiet, he turned to the conductor, nodded his head, and the symphony began. As soon as he started, he had just played the first few notes, where one of the strings on his violin snapped with a very, very loud sound. And he was close enough to the beginning that all he really needed to do was to stop the concert, fix the violin, which can be fixed, put another string, and start again. But he didn't. He signaled to the conductor that he was continuing, and in his mind, on the spot, started to rearrange the music in his head with the remaining three strings that he had. So he had to was a whole different piece, but in playing with the orchestra that he was playing with, he was able on the spot to rearrange the whole music and to keep playing only with the three strings that he had. So he played with a tremendous excitement, spontaneity, of course, you know, rearranging the whole thing. And when he finally finished, he put down the violin. The story goes that the audience sat for a moment in complete stunned silence. And then all of a sudden, spontaneously, they rose to their feet and just cheered wildly. I mean, it was just an unbelievable accomplishment, right? Because they understood, they weren't all musicians, but they understood that they'd just been witness to one of the most greatest performances ever. So Yitzhak Perlman raised his violin for a second, and he asked for quiet. And then he said, it's the task of the artist to make beautiful music with what you have left. Right? And in the place where I saw the story, they conclude and they say, we have to wonder, was he speaking of his violin strings or his crippled body? And then they ask the question, but is it true only of the artist? In other words, we are all artists. Right? We all have a symphony to play. We all have strings that break. Everyone. And I don't think anyone's an exception to that on any level, because we all have our little peckle. You know, the story goes, everyone's got their little peckle, right? Everyone's got their strings that break, everyone's got their challenges. The question we have to ask ourselves are we going to stop the concert and put our whole focus in fixing the string, or are we going to learn to produce beautiful music with the three strings that we still have? And that's, I think, sets the foundation for developing a mindset of gratitude. We can only, and we're going to develop this in greater detail hopefully over the next number of weeks, but the point I think that's going to come across the whole time is to learn to make music with the three strings that we have. Don't forget, three strings is more than one. And if we really look at our lives with all the broken strings that we have, we'll have to learn to realize that we've got more fixed strings and more better strings than broken strings. And those strings can produce beautiful music, and we have a lot to be grateful for. But it takes processing and it takes a lot of work. And that's what we'll do hopefully over the next few weeks. Have a great week. Thank you.